Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
The midday sun hung high in the sky, flooding the fertile fields of Lombardy with unbroken light. It was hot here in September of the year 1427. The late summer rays cooking the ripening fields of wheat surrounding the road as it led down toward a narrow stone bridge. The tramping of feet and hooves and the creaking of wagon wheels competed for space with the buzzing of cicadas and the chirping of birds. A column of soldiers sweated and baked in the heat, looking longingly ahead to the riverbank. Trees for shade, fresh water to drink, a respite from the march. These men were mercenaries paid by the Duke of Milan, guarding a train of wagons carrying vital grain and fodder for his army. There was a war on, a war with the Republic of Venice. For months now, the two armies had circled and probed, raided and skirmished, but nobody seemed particularly eager to fight a major battle. Still, there was risk, and so the soldiers carried their swords and crossbows and wore their armor even as the beating sun cooked them. The column slowed as it neared the bridge. A wagon blocked the far side. Something was up. As the soldiers bunched together, looking to see what was happening, figures appeared behind the wagon in the trees on the far side. Crossbow strings twanged, and the air was suddenly full of dozens of hurtling bolts. Screams and the thud of sharp points entering flesh joined the whizzing of the bolts, and shouts of confusion soon joined them as the mercenaries tried to figure out what was going on. The thunder of hooves added to the cacophony. Dozens of men-at-arms in full armor plate, riding armored horses, lances leveled, emerged from behind a stand of trees and charged toward the stunned mercenaries from behind. The clang of steel on steel, and even more screams and shouts entered the air. Their first charge done, the lancers wheeled around and retreated, reformed, and then charged again, slamming home just as hard. The crossbow bolts continued to fly. The second charge was enough. The mercenaries threw down their weapons and raised their hands. A shouted order brought an end to the fire from the crossbows. The men-at-arms immediately halted just before reforming for a third charge. One of them pulled off his helmet, the hard sunlight glinting off the polished steel. He was a young man in his early 20s, with a fresh scar across the bridge of his nose. When he spoke, the rest obeyed, and they spread out to take the weapons from the ambushed mercenaries. There would be no massacre of prisoners here. This was war for profit, not savagery. They were all professionals here. In the next year's campaign, the victorious young commander might be fighting for the Duke of Milan. The prisoners could just as easily have contracts in his squadron. For now, they could be held to ransom, made to pay for the misfortune of getting captured. The dead were stripped of their precious armor and any valuables and tossed in a nearby ditch. War for profit was ruthless. Margins were tight. The condottieri, the mercenaries of Italy, were the best in Europe at what they did. In a time of constant warfare, incentives met need to produce incredible innovation and professionalism. That legacy eventually shaped war in the rest of Europe, producing some of the later Middle Ages' greatest characters along the way.
Hey, it's Patrick, and I've got some really exciting news. You can now listen to our entire back catalog completely ad-free, exclusively, on Stitcher Premium. If you enjoyed our episodes on the Black Death, on chivalry, on peasants, that great interview we did with friend of the show Dan Jones on the Knights Templar, you can come back to that completely ad-free anytime you want. In addition to our archive, you can also listen to every new episode ad-free, as well as tons of other ad-free Wondery shows like Dirty John, Dr. Death, and American Innovations. Plus, with Stitcher Premium, you'll get access to hundreds of hours of original content, audio documentaries, and exclusive bonus episodes from some of your other favorite podcasts. You can sign up now for a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and using the promo code Wondery. Then, once you're signed up, just download the Stitcher app for iOS or Android and start listening. That's stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and promo code Wondery.
Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm your host, Patrick Wyden. Thanks for joining me. Renaissance Italy, the Italy of the 14th and the 15th centuries was a world of endless plots, backstabbing diplomacy, and decade after decade of war. The incredible art and rediscovery of classical culture that we associate with the Renaissance was inseparable from the dog-eat-dog political environment of the day. It was the same people reading Cicero and doing back-channel diplomacy to isolate an enemy. The Machiavellian political intriguers were also patrons of art and architecture. This was a crucible where states either forged themselves into efficient political machines capable of taking the heat of war with tax-collecting bureaucracies and experts on diplomacy and the art of persuasion, or they got swallowed up by their neighbors. The recipe for military innovation, or really any innovation across history, is a combination of needs and incentives. A problem or problems needs to get solved, and there are significant rewards for those who figure out how to solve them. Late medieval Europe was riven with conflict, and it had a number of different theaters where that was true. Northern Europe's Hundred Years' War, the Castilian campaigns in Granada, Charles the Bold's Burgundy, and so on. Yet all of them paled in comparison to Italy, where the fractured political landscape and incredible wealth created the perfect conditions for cutting-edge warfare. The major powers of the peninsula fought almost without a break between 1350 and 1454, and only stopped then because of a combination of exhaustion and a labyrinthine peace agreement. The next 40 years, the years of peace from 1454 to 1494, were hardly any less violent. All of those wars were carried out by generations of mercenaries, the condottieri, professional soldiers who made war into both an art and a science. Their innovations and practices eventually diffused into Europe as a whole and became part of the fundamental structure of European warfare. If you've ever heard of the condottieri, it's probably through Machiavelli, who famously denounced them and the kind of warfare they practiced. Quote, "Wars were commenced without fear," he wrote, "continued without danger, and concluded without loss." Machiavelli had his reasons for thinking this, but he was dead wrong. Condottieri were the most skilled soldiers of the age, a model for the rest of Europe, and their wars were far from bloodless. Today, we'll follow the development of war in Italy over this 150-year period, a time that produced incredible characters and wild swings of fortune. Double crosses, betrayals, clever victories, and bloody debacles. We'll have a guide to help us understand this confusing world, a condottiere named Jacopo. That's the young commander we met at the beginning, with the fresh scar across his nose, and we'll return to him shortly. But first, we have to understand how this particular world of warfare came into being, and how it was connected with the broader context of both Italian politics and Europe as a whole. A note here, for most of today's episode, I'm going to be drawing heavily on a book by the historian Michael Mallett called Mercenaries and Their Masters, Warfare in Renaissance Italy. It's a pretty good book, and it's pretty accessible if you want to take a look. So, in last week's episode, I talked about how late medieval Italy was something of a world apart from the rest of Europe. Urban instead of rural, exceptionally rich from industrial production and trade, and dominated by city-states and other small political units instead of kings and emperors. This hadn't always been the case. Up until about 1320, the German Holy Roman emperors had taken an active hand in Italian affairs. French kings and nobles had made their mark, too. The Aragonese were a big deal in Sicily and Naples. But for most of the years between 1350 and 1494, the rest of Europe mostly had other concerns. The Hundred Years' War was raging, and so were the civil wars that struck pretty much every major power in the later 15th century. Sure, there was some foreign involvement in Italy during this time. Hungarians, Aragonese, some French, but for the most part, the powers of Italy were left to their own affairs. There was one glaring exception to the lack of foreign involvement, and that was in the realm of warfare. Foreign mercenaries, especially Germans, had a long history in Italy. This was the legacy of the influence of the Holy Roman Emperors, who regularly headed south across the Alps with large armies in tow. Many of their soldiers ended up staying behind. Others told their friends and families back home in Germany that there was money to be made fighting for the fractious city-states of Italy. These were the first of the companies, which sprouted up in the couple of decades before 1350 and then dominated Italian warfare in the second half of the 14th century. The first of the great companies was led by a guy named Werner von Oerslingen, and it was a serious force. 3,000 armored men-at-arms and support troops, enough that they could blackmail cities for protection money all over central Italy in 1342 before heading back to Germany with their money in tow. Werner showed up in Italy a second time in 1349 with an even larger great company, fighting for the King of Hungary in Naples, and he made a boatload of money doing this. Werner retired back home to Germany, but his great company stayed behind under the leadership of a guy named Fra Moriale, a former Hospitaller knight who had turned to mercenary work. The great company was a model of discipline and professionalism and boasted some 10,000 fighting men, larger than any other army in Italy. Italian cities had no choice but to pay it for the privilege of not getting sacked. The great company wasn't invincible. Militias from Florence and other mercenaries beat it on a couple of occasions. But it was a dominant, semi-independent force in Italian politics until the early 1360s. After Moriale's death, a German, a guy named Conrad von Landau, took it over and led it pretty well. If an Italian state wanted to win a war against another state, paying the great company was a pretty effective way of doing it. Despite its effectiveness, developments north of the Alps soon put an end to the great company. The Treaty of Bretigny in 1360 put an end to the first phase of the Hundred Years' War between England and France. Thousands of battle-hardened soldiers who had gotten used to a violent life were suddenly unemployed. France was inundated with these bands, called free companies or routiers, and they terrorized the countryside. Villages were put to the torch, towns were set to ransom, and those who didn't want to suffer that fate paid for the privilege. Now, some of these were essentially small bands of brigands, but others were large-scale, highly organized operations. They were the same structures that had existed within the armies of England and France, just independent now. One of these companies, which had about 6,000 men, headed to Italy in 1361. It quickly found itself in an environment conducive to its talents. The great company ran up against these newcomers and was shattered in open battle. These new arrivals became known as the White Company, and its members were called Inglesi, English. Interestingly, most of them weren't English. The White Company's first leader was a German named Albert Sterz, and plenty of the rank and file were German, Gascon, French, and whatnot. What mattered a lot more than where they were from was the fact that the White Company was right on the leading edge of warfare in the middle of the 14th century, up to date on all the latest developments in the Hundred Years' War. The reason they were called the White Company was because they wore more plate armor than was usual in Italy, which they burnished to a gleaming sheen, hence white. Men-at-arms, the heavily armored corps, fought dismounted in the fashion of the English at the battles of Crécy and Poitiers and later Agincourt. English longbows were a common sight at first, though they became less so as the new recruits with the demanding technical skills necessary to use them effectively weren't forthcoming from England. Above all, the White Company was composed of skilled and disciplined professionals. They knew how to campaign through the winter, they knew how to maintain order on the march, they knew how to keep formation under pressure on the battlefield. More than anything, this last piece would be the White Company's legacy in Italy: professionalism. At first, the White Company was a consortium of bands of mercenaries, each with its own elected captain. After a while, though, one man emerged as its leader, an Englishman named John Hawkwood, maybe the most famous mercenary of the Middle Ages, a brilliant general, businessman, and politician who left a strong mark on Italy for the rest of the Middle Ages. Hawkwood has often been portrayed romantically as a poor boy who made good as a soldier, but that's not the case. According to the historian William Cafaro, who literally wrote the book on Hawkwood and on whom I'm drawing here, the Englishman actually came from a well-off family in the Essex countryside. He was the second son of a prosperous landowner, and when his brother inherited the lot in 1340, Hawkwood needed to find a new career. He tried his hand as a tailor, but decided that war fit his talents a little bit better. According to tradition, which is plausible here, Hawkwood joined the English army in France as a longbowman beginning in 1342. The details are scanty, but he probably served under the Earls of Oxford and Northampton, a pair of experienced soldiers, and there's some reason to think that he fought at both Crecy and Poitiers. What's certain is that Hawkwood went to Italy with the White Company in 1361, and he was already a leader among them at that point. Hawkwood burst onto the scene as a full-fledged captain in 1363, when the city of Pisa hired him to lead its forces in an ongoing war with Florence. When we talk about the dynamics of Italian warfare, this was a typical spat. two cities fighting over commercial rights, in this case, a tariff Pisa had placed on Florentine goods. The precise details of the war are confusing, but it involved a lot of plundering of Florentine territory and then a double cross by most of the mercenaries Pisa had hired, who were bribed to go over to Florence's side. Hawkwood stayed loyal to Pisa. Now, this has traditionally been cast as a statement of Hawkwood's honesty and morality as a mercenary captain, but it was probably that Pisa just hadn't paid him yet, and he wouldn't get paid at all if he jumped ship. It was a business decision of exactly the kind that defined the condottiere, as was his comrade's decision to go with a better offer. In the campaign that followed, Hawkwood and Pisa lost, but Hawkwood gained fame for making the best of a bad situation. Hawkwood's actions over the following years followed the twists and turns of Italian politics, with the great companies of mercenaries as a powerful semi-independent force. The White Company disintegrated, but Hawkwood reassembled a new army from its remnants, with increasing numbers of Italian rather than foreign soldiers. He took service with Bernabò Visconti of Milan, fighting against the Pope, and then attacked Perugia and Siena for reasons of personal revenge and plunder. After 1375, Hawkwood fought for the Pope, but left after participating in a horrific massacre of more than 5,000 people, ordered by the papal legate, a cardinal, in the city of Cesena. Hawkwood never fought for the Pope again. He was the most feared and respected mercenary commander in Italy after 1378, with his own lands and towns and the hand of Bernabò Visconti's daughter in marriage. He won a major battle as the commander for the city of Padua in 1387, then led Florence's armies in a war with Gian Galeazzo Visconti of Milan between 1390 and 1392. He died, still in Florence's service, in 1394. It's an irony of history that Hawkwood is remembered as a hero and a loyal soldier for Florence. In reality, Hawkwood was a cold-blooded mercenary who fought for himself and whomever would pay him. If he had any loyalty, it was to England, not to Florence. Whoever would pay him, at the end of his life, happened to be Florence, and it suited Florence's politics to portray Hawkwood as a loyal mercenary, mostly to keep their current mercenaries, generations later, in line. This is the context for the famous fresco in the Duomo of Florence by Paolo Uccello, a reminder to the disloyal condottieri of the 1430s, decades later, that they ought to behave themselves. It's likewise ironic that Hawkwood is probably the most famous condottiere of the Italian Renaissance and seems like the prototype, a foreign mercenary, a professional expert in war, leading many foreign troops in independent or semi-independent fashion. In fact, Hawkwood was the last of this type to play a major role in Italy. By 1380, the age of the great independent companies, permanent or semi-permanent armies, was dying out. So was the age of foreigners dominating Italian warfare, to the extent that that had ever really been true. There were plenty of Italian mercenary commanders and soldiers during this entire period. Hawkwood was the last of his kind, and by the end of his life, practically all his soldiers were Italian. As the Hundred Years' War heated back up in Northern Europe, there was a lot less incentive for foreigners to come south to seek their fortune in Italy. On top of that, probably more important, Italians had learned the lessons that English, French, and German mercenaries had brought to the peninsula. War was taking its own direction in Italy. Our friend and condottiere Jacopo will be our guide to this next phase.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
The square tower jutted upward toward the sky. Perched on a rocky outcropping, framed against the spiky ridges of the Apennine Mountains to the west, it overlooked rolling hills covered in thin vineyards, stunted olive groves, and some dry wheat fields. A low stone wall surrounded it. A poor village, really just a cluster of dusty huts, sat at the foot of the outcropping, both literally and figuratively, in the tower's shadow. Peasants out in the fields mopped sweat from their brows and startled at the sudden sound of steel clashing on steel from the castle's courtyard, echoing down off the rolling hills. Up in the courtyard, a young man in his mid-teens sparred with a grizzled older man, both of them using blunted swords. The steel rang dully, mixed with the occasional thud as the older man thumped the teenager when he got careless or overreached. A third man, the lord of this humble castle, kept a watchful eye on the other two. These weren't rich lands, though they had been in the family for generations. Fighting was their identity, and increasingly, their profession. And his son, the sparring teenager, would follow in his footsteps. The life of a condottiere awaited when he reached adulthood. This teenager is our friend Jacopo. The year is 1420, and this castle lies in the eastern foothills of the Apennine Mountains, with the Adriatic Sea a few dozen miles to the east. The castle sits at the center of a small lordship, one that has belonged to the family for more than 100 years. Jacopo's great-great-grandfather had built it around the end of the 13th century, a monument to his rise from humble soldier to the ranks of the true nobility, and a base at the center of his newly granted lands. The succeeding generations had all stayed soldiers, serving their feudal overlords and taking contracts to fight for nearby cities as mercenaries. Jacopo will do the same. We generally think of Renaissance Italy as a land of cities, of merchants and bankers and powerful craft guilds and trade. The Great Dome of Florence's Cathedral and the Arsenal of Venice all serve as stand-ins for this world. Now, I'm guilty of this. It's what I focused on last week. And it makes sense because Italy was more urban and wealthier, and it was more full of merchant bankers than the rest of Europe. The contrast with an almost entirely rural France or England, ruled by a military nobility from bases in the countryside, is what makes Italy stand out. But it's possible to push that characterization too far. Italy still had castles, a lot of them. It still had rural nobles who thought of themselves as a military class who lived in those castles. Lower lords were tied to higher lords in a chain of hierarchy and obligation, what we can see as the feudal system. Entire regions were effectively ruled by that nobility, especially Naples, the hinterland of Genoa, and the Romagna, the region south of Ravenna on the east coast of Italy. Our friend Jacopo is from the Romagna, and he belongs to this military class. Now, as you might expect, it works a bit differently when there's no king who commands the nobility's ultimate loyalty. The presence of so many cities with so much money and so many people likewise changed the dynamic. Lots of rural lords aspired to rule nearby cities, for example, and cities tried to dominate the surrounding countryside and the nobles who lived there. There was a lot more money floating around in Italy than in, say, the Welsh Marches or central France, so military service in return for cash payment made more sense. In effect, the military nobility, who could draw on their lands to recruit soldiers, formed a professional group whose services could be bought by the highest bidder. As the foreign captains and great independent companies faded from the scene, the structures of contract warfare were taken over by Italy's native military nobles. The first great Italian condottiere was a noble from the Romagna, a guy named Alberigo da Barbiano. Alberigo had served under John Hawkwood before striking out on his own and serving Milan and later Naples with distinction. He was one of a whole generation of nobles from the Romagna to take that path, including the Dieste lords of Ferrara and the Gonzagas of Mantua, all of whom combined lordship and work as condottieri. The most famous of those nobles from the Romagna was named Muzio Attendolo, who came from a family of well-off rural notables in the small town of Cotignola, a few miles outside Ravenna. Let's say, for the sake of our story, that our friend Jacopo is a distant cousin of the Attendolos. After all, Jacopo's family castle is only 15 or 20 miles away from Cotignola. Jacopo's father has fought for Muzio Attendolo as a captain, recruiting and commanding a chunk of dozens or even 100 men-at-arms. It's good pay, and the work has taken Jacopo's father from Florence and Milan to Bologna and now Naples. With Jacopo coming of age, it's his turn to begin his military apprenticeship. There's no better place to learn the trade than the company of Muzio Attendolo. This is Jacopo's social world. He was raised in the countryside, a member of a tight-knit extended family of nobility who were simultaneously territorial lords with their own ambitions and professional soldiers. Jacopo's father recruited crossbowmen and men-at-arms from their lands and their cousins' lands near theirs to serve under him. At the same time, he was always on the lookout for another little village to add to his own lands, and he wouldn't begrudge using his little private army to enforce that. In this sense, they weren't that different from the English minor nobles who stocked the armies of Edward III and Henry V during the Hundred Years' War, or who fought the Wars of the Roses so viciously a few decades later. The basic shift all across Europe was from old-school feudal warfare, where military service was carried out on a limited time in exchange for land, to a contractual basis. The English armies of the Hundred Years' War were all contract armies, where individual captains recruited a set number of longbowmen and men-at-arms and were paid by the crown. These captains were generally nobles. They recruited from their own lands and the surrounding territory, signing contracts called indentures. As that war went on, French nobles did the same. There, the contracts were called lettres de revenu. The deal was pretty similar in Germany as well, with contractors recruiting a set number of soldiers for their employer. In Italy, that contract was called a condotta, hence condottiere, meaning contractor, someone who holds a contract. The big difference was that in Italy, the subjects of these contracts weren't fighting for their ruler. That had some serious implications that we'll come back to later. So our friend Jacopo, now around 15 years old, sets off to join the company of Muzio Attendolo. Attendolo's nickname is Sforza, meaning strong, and it's an epithet he'll pass to his son Francesco, and the dynasty Francesco will eventually found in the Duchy of Milan. For now, though, Muzio is just a condottiere, albeit one of the most famous and effective in Italy. On heading south to Naples, where Muzio's army is currently in the service of its queen Joanna, Jacopo immediately sees familiar faces. An uncle, a whole bunch of cousins, family friends, acquaintances from near his home, crossbowmen who grew up on his family's lands. Muzio Attendolo draws heavily from that region, just as all major condottieri had their own bases from which to recruit. Muzio's company is the perfect training ground for a career soldier. Above all, it's a disciplined and professional organization. It's existed in some form for nearly two decades, since Muzio was commanding 180 lances, basically a lance was a squad organized around a mounted men-at-arms, in the service of Florence. Since then, the company has grown from the hundreds into the thousands. They fought for the Pope, the city of Ferrara, and now the Kingdom of Naples, which has been Muzio's employer for a few years at this point. The company's numbers ebb and flow, as individual soldiers and lower-level captains come and go with their contracts, break off to join other condottieri, or leave the profession entirely. Active campaigns require more soldiers than peacetime, obviously. The corps always remains around Muzio, though, and it's both a professional army and a political tool in its commander's hands. On a couple of occasions, the company has bailed out Muzio when he's made a bad political decision, got himself thrown into prison, or found some other trouble. That right there is one of the defining features of this particular phase of the condottieri, from about 1380 to 1425. Captains like Muzio Attendolo had political aspirations. They could use their armies to carve out territory for themselves and act like political players. They were independent, like the foreign great companies of the previous generation had been, but they were also playing the game of Italian politics, like natives, for their own benefit. Jacopo was raised in a family of soldiers, so when he arrives at Muzio's camp, he already knows the basics of fighting. How to handle a sword and a lance, how to fight from horseback, how to move in a full suit of heavy plate armor. Those are the same skills any young minor nobleman would learn anywhere in Europe, whether he grew up in Andalusia or Swabia or Picardy or the Welsh Marches. Men with those skills, wearing thick armor and wielding sword and lance, were at the core of every armed force on the continent, even the English armies with their famous longbowmen. The condottieri were built around them too. The lance was the basic unit of most medieval armies, with a single man-at-arms on horseback, a support soldier or two, and a page to look after the horses. It was essentially a squad, and Jacopo was part of one as the man-at-arms. What Jacopo learns in Muzio's company over the next few years is professionalism, what's becoming an art and science of war. We'll talk more about this a little later, but it's worth repeating now. Jacopo learns to fight in formation, to execute complex maneuvers in the heat of battle, and above all, to maintain discipline. It takes him several years to learn all this, during which Muzio's army marches and marches and marches some more across southern Italy without doing much fighting. Jacopo draws his pay and learns. He learns, and he learns some more, all the while getting adjusted to the life. It's not a bad one as these things go. Muzio Attendolo is a highly sought-after commander. He's a charismatic and intelligent guy, prone to giving inspirational speeches, and he has the respect of his soldiers. He's crafty and physically powerful. There's a lot for a young condottiere like Jacopo to learn from a man like this, who has attracted and retained talented subordinates for decades. In 1424, Jacopo was 19 years old. He'd had already spent 4 years in Muzio's company without seeing much action. But that would soon change. Muzio's great rival for the crown of finest military commander in Italy was a condottiere named Braccio da Mantone, who was also the lord of the city of Perugia in central Italy. Where Muzio was all ice and caution, Braccio was fire and flash, and Braccio's flair usually got the better of Muzio. With serious military chops, Braccio carved out the lordship of Perugia for himself, and he was really the archetype of the ambitious condottiere slash lord in this period. In 1423, Braccio tried to add to his collection of lands and cities by besieging the rebellious city of L'Aquila, also in central Italy. This was going too far, and a coalition organized against it. Muzio Attendolo saw an opportunity to mix business and pleasure, and he marched north from Naples against his old rival in the middle of winter. Jacopo was with him, shivering in the December and January mud as Muzio's army headed north through the craggy hills and ridges of the Abruzzi. On January 4th of 1424, the army reached the Pescara River, which was swollen by winter rainfall. A page fell into the water, and Muzio, wearing full armor, tried to jump in and save him. The condottiere drowned, swept away by the rushing water as Jacopo looked on. It was an odd end for a famous general. Muzio's son, Francesco, soon to be Sforza, was present with the army and immediately took over. Francesco was a few years older than our friend Jacopo. He was already an experienced fighter with a keen eye for politics. He was popular with the soldiers, Jacopo included, who marveled at his feats of strength. Jacopo had seen Francesco bend an iron bar with his bare hands, his thick neck bulging with the strain. He soon proved himself a gifted leader in his own right. As winter turned into the burning summer of central Italy, Francesco's mercenaries were joined by soldiers from Naples and Milan. Braccio was still besieging L'Aquila, and the Allied army approached. It was June 5th, a blisteringly hot day. The sun beat down on the metal plates of Jacopo's armor. He and the rest of Francesco's soldiers were on the left side of the army. Jacopo was part of the reserve squadrons, held back from the main body. He could hear the sounds of battle ahead of him, see the collision of men-at-arms before they disappeared into the rising clouds of summer dust. His lance already felt heavy in his hand. He could hear his pulse pounding inside his helmet. Then he heard the order to advance. Along with the rest of his comrades, he put spurs to his horse, moving to a trot. Then, as one unit, they began to gallop. They swerved through a maze of corpses, then saw the enemy ahead. With a crash of steel on steel and neighing horses, they slammed into Braccio's remaining soldiers, who gave way and broke, running back, leaving behind trails of dead and dying men. Braccio was among them, blood gushing from his neck. He would die 3 days later. The death of Braccio da Mantone marked the end of the second phase of the condottiere, where Italian commanders, rather than foreign ones, dominated, but with a keen eye toward their own ambitions and advancement. There would be a few condottieri who would make good later. Francesco Sforza, Jacopo's commander and Muzio's son, was the most prominent of them. But things were changing. States wanted more control over their condottieri. That was the world of war in which Jacopo would come of age.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
After the Battle of the Aquila, both of the large mercenary armies, those of Braccio and formerly Muzio, broke up. Francesco Sforza retained the core of an army, and he went on to have a long, thrilling, and rewarding career, which ended as Duke of Milan. We'll come back to him shortly. But for the sake of exploring this world a little more fully, let's take Jacopo somewhere else, somewhere a little more reflective of the general path Condottieri took in the years after 1424. There's a long-standing stereotype, which I mentioned back at the beginning of the episode in Machiavelli's words, that the wars that Condottieri fought were bloodless affairs. Everybody just wanted to get paid and get out safely, so why put yourself in harm's way? But that wasn't really the case. Braccio's army at L'Aquila was full of mercenaries. Their opponents were mercenaries, too. Hundreds and probably thousands of them died there, just as hundreds died in many other engagements during this incessant century of warfare. That incorrect stereotype of bloodless greed is actually pointing toward a few of the genuine facets of war in Italy at this point. The baseline thing was this. Soldiers like Jacopo, trained in the army of Muzio Vitendolo and heir to three generations of professionalized warfare from Hawkwood and the great companies on, were all pretty good at what they did. War wasn't an amateur or semi-pro game here, as it often was elsewhere in Europe, carried out by a military class without much consistent experience in the actual waging of war. Campaigns, tactics, strategy, logistics, all of that stuff. No skilled condottiere would have advanced slowly across a muddy field into volley after volley after volley of arrows, as the French chose to do at Agincourt. Nor would they have gotten caught with their supply lines so dangerously overstretched, as the English King Henry V was on that same campaign, which is why he had to fight against such awful odds in the first place. Serious condottieri were cautious by nature, because there was absolutely no margin for error when dealing with other professional soldiers. There weren't as many decisive bloodbath types of battles in Italy during this time, simply because skilled commanders avoided the types of engagements that produced those outcomes. A great victory requires a great loser. Disciplined troops were unlikely to break and run, which was when they were most likely to be slaughtered or captured in large numbers. For the record, that suited their employers, Venice, Florence, Milan, and so on, just fine. If you lose a battle like that, if you lose a whole army, then your city could be permanently swallowed up by its enemies. All of the incentives of war in Italy were set up not so much to win crushing victories as to avoid crushing losses. The practices of war were set up to match those incentives. That was what Jacopo had learned from Muzio Vitendolo. Caution, meticulous attention to detail, and above all, discipline. After Muzio's death and the end of the L'Aquila campaign, Jacopo was 20 years old. He was ready to set out on a career as a condottiere in his own right. For now, he hired on in the company of a condottiere named Michelotto Vitendolo, a cousin of Muzio's and another distant relation of Jacopo himself. They were in the service of the Pope, at least for a couple of years, and the pay was good without much actual fighting. At this point, Jacopo was a man-at-arms, the bedrock of the Italian military system. He owned several horses, including one suitable for carrying an armored rider into battle. A lance and a long sword, used with either one or two hands, made up his typical arms. He wore a full suit of plate armor, topped with an open-faced helmet called a barbute, with a T-shaped opening for the eyes and mouth. The armor is really what defined him and his role. It was incredibly expensive, and it was right on the cutting edge of design, a product of the churning armories of the city of Milan. Outside the slit for his eyes and mouth, which allowed him unimpeded vision and the ability to breathe, he was completely protected by metal plates. The armor was heavy, but not bulky, as we might think stereotypically. It was no problem for Jacopo to run, jump, roll, and fight for substantial periods of time. Despite its flexibility, it offered great protection. It would take a serious blow from a heavy poleaxe or a point-blank shot from a crossbow to punch through the steel plate. Even Jacopo's horse wore plate armor called barding to protect it. This kind of armor was becoming increasingly common across Europe, and it was imported from Milan and other Italian armories to France, England, and Spain in large quantities. The battlefields of the Wars of the Roses were littered with fine imported Italian armor. But it wasn't just the armor that made Jacopo special. It was his training. He not only had the individual skills of handling his weapon and his horse, but he trained regularly with other men who were armed and armored in similar ways. They could fight in disciplined formations. They could wheel and charge and retreat on command. They could split into smaller groups or reform as necessary. Now, men-at-arms all across Europe had the raw punch of a thundering charge, their lances propelled forward by the massive weight of armored men on armored horses. Jacopo and other professional condottieri could do that, but they could also do a lot more. It made them sought-after hires even north of the Alps. The Armagnac faction in the Hundred Years' War hired men-at-arms from Milan in 1423 to fight against the Burgundians. 2,000 of them were in the French army that fought the English at the Battle of Verneuil in northern France in 1424. They performed admirably there, even as the rest of the French were destroyed in a grinding and disastrous melee. On an individual basis, not much set Jacopo apart from a French or English or German man-at-arms. His armor may have been a little bit better. He may have been a little more skilled with his weapons. But what really distinguished him and the Italians as a whole from what was happening elsewhere in Europe at this time was the fact that he was a professional. He was part of a professional group that trained and fought together. He and the men he hired on with and trained with could do things in the heat of battle, with crossbow bolts pinging off their armor, the summer sun beating down, their pulse pounding, that required incredible focus and preparation. Even if there was a lot of turnover from year to year, the new hires were usually drawn from the same institutional background. There were minor differences between how the major condottieri ran their companies and what they emphasized, but they all shared the same commitment to discipline and training. After a couple of years with Michelotto Attendolo in papal service, Jacopo decided it was time to find a better and more lucrative deal. War was heating up between Venice and Milan, and both sides were hiring soldiers. Now, Jacopo decided, was the time to take a step up from being a simple man-at-arms to being a real condottiere. He convinced a few other men-at-arms from Michelotto's company to join him, and he wrote home to his father and cousins to see if any others could be found. As he headed north toward Venice, which he thought would be a more reliable paymaster than Visconti Milan, Jacopo gathered a dozen men-at-arms and their supporting troops. They joined the army of Francesco da Carmagnola, a wily and experienced soldier whom Venice had hired away from Milan to lead its armies against his former employer, Filippo Maria Visconti, the Duke of Milan. So how did this work? How did you join a condottiere's army? Well, you did it by signing a contract, a condotta. Hence, condottiere, meaning someone with a condotta. Jacopo's condotta wasn't signed with Venice, but with Francesco da Carmagnola, and he had negotiated it by letter before even leaving home. The first clause of the contract specified that Jacopo would provide a dozen lances, the basic unit of the army, each led by a man-at-arms, with two supporting soldiers each. The second clause set out the duration, 6 months firm, plus an additional six-month period di rispetto, if the employer wished to retain the services of Jacopo and his men. The third and final clause involved pay. There would be an immediate payment upon signing the contract, called the prestanza. This amounted to a quarter of the total, and it would cover the costs for Jacopo to bring himself and his men north to meet Carmagnola's army. There was also a monthly payment and various bonuses for bravery and good service, along with provisions about how the loot acquired on campaign was to be divided. If this reminds you of the complex arrangements we talked about with the Medici Bank, it should. This was the exact same world of contracts and commerce. The condottieri lived in an environment that was half old-school feudal warfare and half cutting-edge business. So with money in hand, Jacopo and his men-at-arms joined Francesco da Carmagnola and the Venetian army. This brings us back to the scene at the beginning, with Jacopo ambushing those Milanese soldiers. They campaigned through the Po Valley in northern Italy and captured the city of Brescia from the Milanese, but Carmagnola dithered. Maybe he was just being overly cautious with a strong enemy army close, but more likely, he was trying to stretch out his contract and get maximum value for minimum effort. Finally, facing pressure from his Venetian employers, Carmagnola invaded Milanese territory. The Milanese army met them near the town of Meclodium, and the result was a massive victory for Carmagnola and Jacopo along with him. More than 8,000 Milanese soldiers were captured. The aftermath of the battle says a great deal about the downsides of war in Italy, those complaints that Machiavelli and many others pointed to over the years. Carmagnola released the prisoners without their weapons and armor, who were immediately rearmed from stocks created by the thriving Milanese arms industry. Carmagnola retired into winter quarters instead of immediately following up by taking the now defenseless cities in Milanese territory. A great victory turned into absolutely nothing of value for the Venetians, despite the huge amounts of money they'd spent hiring Carmagnola and men like Jacopo for a full campaign. Over the next few years, Carmagnola listened to offers from the Visconti to defect and bring his troops over to the Milanese side. This was a constant risk for the states employing condottieri. There was always the problem that their opponents might offer them a better deal. Carmagnola finally tested Venetian patience one too many times, and he was executed in 1432. He wasn't the first or the last condottiere to suffer that fate. Many of the great condottieri were experts at dragging on campaigns to maximize their earnings and their leverage. I mentioned before that they were cautious by nature, and caution could easily become inactivity. Filippo Maria Visconti, Duke of Milan, frustrated by huge outlays of money and little return, said this in 1441, quote, "These condottieri have now reached the stage when, if they are defeated, we pay for their failures, and if victors, we must satisfy their demands and throw ourselves at their feet, even more than if they were our enemies. Must the Duke of Milan bargain for the victory of his own troops and strip himself to receive favors from them?" This sums up a lot about the problems with hiring condottieri to fight for you. Even if they won a major victory, there was always a risk that they might turn on you or desert you. After Carmagnola's execution, there was plenty of work to go around for Jacopo. He expanded his operation from a dozen men-at-arms to 100, and hired on with his old commander and distant cousin Michelotto Attendolo to fight for Florence. Then it was off to Naples, then a couple of small wars in the Papal States, then north to fight in the army of Francesco Sforza for Venice. When Sforza married Filippo Maria Visconti's daughter and switched to Milan in 1441, Michelotto induced Jacopo and his 100 men-at-arms to stay with Venice for a nice pay raise. The world of the condottieri was changing in the 1440s, just as it had changed several times over the past few generations. States wanted more and more control over their soldiers. This made sense, right? Having to constantly weigh the odds of a condottiere switching sides, as Francesco Sforza had done many times, was a serious problem in the middle of a war. Even if they stayed loyal and won, they might demand better pay, or control over a city, or a vital stretch of territory. They might even trash your own land if the pay wasn't forthcoming. Jacopo was no exception to this. He had switched sides numerous times in the middle of a war when his contract ran out. Venice had given him a small castle and an estate near the Alps as payment on one occasion when cash had been short. States had two responses to this. First, they could simply hire soldiers themselves, cutting out the powerful condottiere captain as a middleman. In cases where a captain died or retired, his troops might sign on directly with Venice or Milan or the Pope in return for fixed rates of pay. Soldiers who took this path were known as lance spezzate, broken lances. Second, relationships between condottieri and their employers grew more formalized. They edged toward permanence. Someone like Jacopo might just sign a long-term contract, perhaps at a slightly reduced rate of pay, but with much greater security over the long run. As he aged into his 40s, toward the end of the long wars between Venice, Milan, and Florence, the prospect of constantly hunting for his next contract became less attractive to Jacopo. He'd never been as ambitious as his distant cousin Francesco Sforza, who was in the process of becoming Duke of Milan in his own right. Jacopo had spent much of his career fighting for Venice, and when an offer came to sign on with La Serenissima Repubblica permanently, Jacopo agreed. The pay was fair. The Republic sweetened the deal with another lovely estate and a castle near Padua. In return, Jacopo provided a few hundred lances and commanded them in the field. As the Peace of Lodi was signed in 1454 and the Italic League formed in the aftermath, standing armies were becoming the norm all across Italy. The treaty that created the Italic League actually required them for member states as an always existing deterrent to the constant warfare that had riven the past few generations. Jacopo saw little action, but kept drawing a paycheck through the 1450s, and he finally retired to his estates just before the Venetians and the Ottomans went to war in 1463. He was lucky to have avoided it, as most of the mercenaries who went to Greece to fight the Ottomans didn't return. By then, Jacopo was nearly 60 years old. He'd been a soldier for more than 40 years. Over the course of his long life, Jacopo had seen the transformation of warfare in Italy. He'd gotten his start with men who had personally known John Hawkwood in their youth, who had seen the great companies of foreigners firsthand. That had been the age of independent companies that could drive their own bargains. The next generation, the one Jacopo learned from just as it was finishing up, was one less of independent companies than independent condottieri. The lords slash soldiers with their own ambitions that they furthered through mercenary warfare. Finally, Jacopo spent his mature years in an environment of increasing permanence, where contracts were longer and more stable, and condottieri were forcibly transformed into servants of an Italian state. Jacopo's fine estates and castle in Venice's terra ferma, the dry land, physically bound him to his employer. He was happy to be tied down in that way. His back ached constantly from the many slipped and herniated discs he'd suffered while wearing heavy armor for years. He had scars, from crossbow bolts, from a sliver of stone sheared off by a passing cannonball, and from that glancing sword blow that had cut across the bridge of his nose. Many shots to the head had left him with a shaky memory. But he was alive, and he was well off, with land and resources to pass on to his children. He had never maneuvered himself into his employer's dungeons, and never earned a dose of poison or an executioner's axe for one double cross too many. That was more than a lot of his contemporaries could say. War for profit had been good to Jacopo. Training, discipline, professionalism. These were the hallmarks of war as the condottieri practiced it. They were early adopters of gunpowder handguns and cannon for the defense of strong points, if not mobile artillery for sieges, as in Northern Europe or the Ottoman Empire. They were fanatical about logistics and supply. They reconnoitered terrain and lines of march in excruciating detail. Most of all, they were experts in fortification. Out in the field, condottieri built fortified camps to protect themselves from nighttime attacks. They dug trenches, they built obstacles, they flooded fields to shape battlefields to their purposes. I mentioned before how thin the margins between victory and defeat were in Italian warfare. In a close battle, putting a ditch in the right place could make all the difference. When it came to cities and fortresses, the condottieri turned military architecture into both a cutting-edge art and science. Cannon presented a fundamental challenge to old castles. Italian military architects, exactly the kinds of well-paid professionals who embodied the meaning of incentive and innovation, rose to meet that challenge. Long, grinding, bloody, expensive sieges would define warfare in the 16th century, and the art and science of the new fortification was born there, in Italy. The Great War of the coming century, the Italian Wars, were largely fought on Italian soil. In these conflicts, the Italian powers were increasingly an afterthought, as Spain, France, and the Holy Roman Empire all ruled through the peninsula. But this coming war was a conduit through which Italian soldiers, the generation of condottieri who followed our friend Jacopo, transmitted what they'd learned to the rest of Europe. The European way of war that emerged in the early modern period had many parents, but Renaissance Italy's condottieri were its fun and influential uncles. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. Sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe and Leah Sutherland. From Wondery, the executive producer is Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths, and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know.
Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.mx/you know.